Hey guys, welcome to the show. It's Hemel and Brian.
Hello everyone.
How are you?
I'm good. It's exciting to be here in your lavishly appointed podcasting studio. Back for season two of the show.
Back for season two of the show. It's been a while since we've talked to everybody.
Before we talk about the Keanu Reeves theme, though, I want to talk about my promotion.
Oh, your promotion. Yes, let's talk about your promotion.
Yes, I was recently promoted by you to full-time co-host of the podcast.
That's right. Brian Minter is no longer a guest on the podcast. He is the co-host of the podcast.
I have a parking space.
That's
I have
true.
A 401k.
And a chair.
And I have a chair. I had a chair before.
But yeah, it's going to be me and Brian for this season. And we've kind of decided to narrow it down a little bit. And by narrowing it down, we want to focus on the films of Keanu Reeves.
No, I have a question for you about that.
Okay.
Why do we want to focus on the films of Keanu Reeves? What about Keanu Reeves speaks to you as an avatar of modern American culture?
I don't have a good reason aside.
Ah, that's terrible.
I don't have a better reason than I really like Keanu Reeves. But this is something that I'm hoping we can really dig deep into.
So you have an intuitive, you have a gut feeling that there's something there. You just haven't articulated it yet.
Yeah, and I wonder if this podcast is going to be a weird, like, academic exercise in terms of Keanu Reeves.
Is it the woodenness of his acting that you're attracted to?
First of all, he starred in some of my favorite films. But he also, he has a really high likability factor as an actor.
Yeah, he's weirdly charismatic. And in the movie we're going to discuss tonight, he performs, I would say, an objectively bad job as an actor. Yet he is fun to watch.
So episode one of Keanu Cast, we're going to tackle Point Break.
Point Break, the classic. Is it a classic American film or is it a cult classic?
I say give it another 10 years and it will be an actual classic, but right now it is a cult classic.
And is it a cop movie? Is it an action movie? Is it a thriller? I have no idea what the movie is.
A mix, a hybrid between a cop. It's supposed to start off as a typical action movie, good guy goes after bad guys. But the thing that makes Point Break so good and so exciting is that it's one of the first movies to make a likable antihero, right? This movie came out in 1991, and it's the first of the genre to actually like flip that trope.
Yeah, this movie is 27 years old.
Even if you can't really pinpoint the genre, can you sum up the plot?
Yeah, well, I would say that in most movies, you have a series of plot points, and each plot point is supported by many scenes. In Point Break, the ratio of plot points to scenes approaches 1-to-1, because every scene, there's a new idea, or a new conflict, or a new character, and they're discarded as soon as the scene is over. There's so much plot in the movie, and almost none of it actually matters very much.
I mean, I think the plot does matter very much, but
no,
I also
the plot is, it's nonsense. In fact, if you tried to sit down and okay, I'll tell.
Okay,
I'll,
let I'll, me yes. let me try. The plot really is an FBI agent goes after bank robbing
with
surfers.
The unlikely name of Johnny Utah.
Stop. All right, so the plot, right, is FBI agent goes after a gang of bank robbing surfers.
Bank robbing surfers.
On the surface, that is the plot.
So with modern movies, I feel like there's a strong distinction between something that is very stylized, like The Matrix or, I don't know, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, and something that is gritty and realistic, like The Usual Suspects or, I don't know, can't think of anything else off the top of my head. With Point Break, though, the visuals are very realistic, right? Like everything is filmed just like it's happening in front of you, but the plot, the character names, the story, it's all borderline nonsensical.
I don't know, though. It doesn't matter that if it's nonsensical.
Are we supposed to take Johnny Utah seriously as the name of the protagonist?
I had written down on my notes that the name Johnny Utah is one of the greatest character names of all time.
You know, the
Johnny Utah.
The working title for the movie was Johnny Utah.
And I would have watched that movie, too.
So what happens in the film? Johnny Utah is a newly minted FBI agent.
Right.
Former pro football player. Former college football player.
College football player.
He comes to San Diego.
Yeah.
Where he is assigned to a unit headed up by Dr. Cox from Scrubs.
Yes.
Who is a ranting lunatic who, for no discernible reason, the first day his new employee comes in, is screaming at him and hates him. For no reason at all.
But that just establishes the kind of guy that he is.
Yeah, he's an asshole.
He's an asshole.
Pointlessly assholish. Right. So he assigns Johnny Utah to be partners with Gary Busey, who is like a 50-year-old There's no way this guy would ever be an FBI agent. He's twice as old as everyone around him. He's wearing Hawaiian shirts, and his name is Papadopoulos. So they're all tracking these crazy bank robbers who wear president masks.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank robbers have hit something like 60 banks in a week.
27,
yeah. Ridiculous figure. And they have no clues. They're a terrible bunch of FBI agents. They have no clues. They have no informants. They have no forensic evidence. And Papadopoulos, out of nowhere, has a theory that they're surfers. And do you remember what his evidence is to back up his theory?
Yeah, it's surf wax, right?
Well, it's that they only rob banks during the summer. And it's, yeah, that they found wax at the scene.
I think that's a pretty good, I think it's pretty good reasoning.
There's no reason that should have held up. And so then,
well,
they take his stupid theory at face value, him and Johnny Utah.
Everybody else does make fun of his theory.
Everyone makes fun of his, all of the pointlessly asshole chef. All their colleagues scream at them the whole time for no reason. They hate them. So then, so Johnny Utah doesn't believe his theory. And then they go out and they scream at each other for a while. And then he decides he does believe his theory. So rather than try to cultivate sources within the surfing community or develop informants or track leads, he decides they have to turn Johnny Utah into a surfer, which takes, like, what, a month?
What? No. Look, so the entire plot is basically that Johnny Utah goes undercover as a surfer,
yes.
Right? Part of the charm of this, though, is that it's Keanu Reeves playing an FBI agent.
Yeah, and it works. It makes sense.
Well,
he's got that clean-cut, dumb American
personality. He's got that clean-cut look to it. Everybody knows Keanu Reeves. You have to think about the context of casting him in this, right?
They only knew him. Bill and Ted.
They know him from Bill and Ted. So for him to go in playing an FBI agent is really playing against type, right?
I actually read that the original casting choices, and this will blow your mind. Maybe you read this too. Matthew Broderick as Johnny Utah.
No.
And Charlie Sheen as Bodie.
Oh, God, that
would have been
awful.
A disaster.
Yeah.
And then when Catherine Bigelow came on as director, her one stipulation was, I want Bill or Ted, whichever he was, because no one knew, to play the lead.
I mean, I think that's an incredible choice, and it's totally brilliant. But yeah, so the plot, of course, on the surface, any plot of an action film, when you try to break it down into rationality, is not really going to hold up, right?
So then, after he infiltrates surfing culture, he meets Bodie, played by Patrick Swayze,
yes.
A golden-haired, wildly charismatic Buddhist surfer god who takes him under his wing, and he meets some evil surfers, one of whom is played by Anthony Kiedis from the Red Hot Chili Peppers in a surprising cameo. The evil surfers, they decide that they're the bank robbers, and they conduct a raid. Johnny Utah, for some reason, goes on the raid, even though he's the undercover guy, and there's no way it wouldn't blow his cover for him to go on the raid.
Well, he's also late.
He's late to the raid, but he shouldn't have gone on the raid in the first place. That was a terrible decision by management. So they go on the raid. For some reason, the evil surfers, because a man knocked on the door, they lose their shit, and they all get machine guns, and there's this really extended, brutal action sequence with Johnny Utah fighting the evil surfers. But then the evil surfers turn out to not be the bank robbers.
Well, they're just a different set of evil surfers.
Yeah, they're other bad surfers.
Yes.
And then Johnny Utah realizes that Bodie and his friends are the bank robbers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how he realized this?
Yes, because a dude pulls down his pants on a wave.
Yeah, a guy pulls down his pants and he realizes that these must be the bank robbers.
So basically he identifies the suspect from a tan line.
No, I don't think the movie's even trying to say that. I think he just has a moment of epiphany.
Right.
He realizes now they are the evil surfers. So then they decide to stake out the bank where they know the surfing gang is going to hit. Again, they're terrible at their jobs because they have one chance to catch these guys. They've been working on this case for months. Dr. Cox is screaming at them. They're on stakeout. They know they're going to rob this bank. What do?
They go get sandwiches.
Johnny Utah goes to get meatball sandwiches, and Papadopoulos reads the newspaper.
Yeah.
And they miss the bank robbery.
Well, to be fair, Papadopoulos is known as a screw-up cop, right? And this is like Johnny's first assignment right out of the academy.
I have no law enforcement training, but I would have known to watch the place I was staking out.
But I love that. I like the comedic value. But right, it goes from there, right? But on surface, yes, those are all the logistical plot points of what happens.
So they catch the tail end of the robbery.
Mm-hmm.
There is an unbelievable action scene, like this 15-minute foot chase where Johnny Utah is chasing Bodie, who's wearing a Ronald Reagan mask.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredibly filmed. Like, it's just nuts. Like, I have no idea how they shot that. And it just goes on and on. And they're running through Los Angeles. They're running through people's houses. At one point, Bodhi throws a pit bull at him. It is a bonkers action sequence. It's unbelievable. So this is where the movie has a genuinely weird, interesting bit, which is at this point, Johnny Utah knows that his friends are the bank robbers.
Yes.
The bank robbers know that their friend Johnny Utah is actually an FBI agent.
Yes.
They still all hang out together, and none of them acknowledge this. But it's not dumb. The movie clearly gives a nod to, yep, they all know what's going on here, but they have this weird psychosexual connection, and they have to keep playing out their adrenaline junkie adventures.
There's that first scene where Johnny Utah and Bodhi each know each other, right? He knows that it's Bodhi,
yes,
and he has a chance to shoot him, but he fires his gun in the air, right? He could have shot him right there when they're on this long chase, and he knows that it's Bodhi wearing the mask.
Yeah.
And he drops down into the end of a ditch, and he blows out his knee.
Yes.
So he can't chase after him. So there's that old college injury coming back to bite him. This movie says a lot of stuff about, like, bodies, like physical bodies.
Yes. Male bodies are on the screen at all times.
But, like, Johnny's body is constantly letting him down when it matters.
Yeah. Do you think that? So, yeah, I think, yeah, A, they're these, like, yeah, the super chiseled tough dudes. And we see a lot of that, which you don't normally see in a movie. But also, yeah, they're physically, they're corporeal, right? They can
right.
be hurt or injured or stopped. Do you think a lot of that is because it was a woman directing an action movie and a man would have had this sort of indestructible Schwarzenegger character?
I want to get to Catherine Bigelow in a second,
oh, sure,
but
sure,
first
sure.
let's like move to the end
right.
of the summary
so
of the film.
So he lets Bodhi gets away.
Right.
And for some inexplicable reason, he discharges his weapon 10 times in the air.
Yeah, it's incredible. That's the best moment of the movie.
Why? Why is that the
because
best moment of the movie?
Because he loves Bodhi. Like, he knows that it's Bodhi.
Yeah.
And he knows that he has a chance to stop him, right? He doesn't
he
have to shoot to kill.
Right.
And he can't do it. And then what Gary
Busey...
Why
does he shoot his gun off in the air?
Because he has so much emotion. He has so much male emotion. He doesn't know what to do with it. So he fires his gun in the air like... obscene amount of times. Like, talk about recklessly discharging your weapon.
Yeah, he could have killed 100 birds. It's weird that you think that's the best moment of the movie.
Well, I think it's one of the most hilariously iconic moments of Keanu Reeves' career is when he can't bring himself to shoot Bodhi and he just like firing it.
Yeah,
in
he doesn't
the air.
Say no, but it's on his face.
After that, there's a lot of stuff that happens in very quick succession. Keanu knows that he's been made. Bodhi knows that he's been made. And they have this very romantic skydiving session. They come to his house.
They wake him up.
They wake him up. They grab his stuff and they take him skydiving.
And they never say, by the way, we realize you're an FBI agent.
Yeah.
And he never says, I know you guys are bank robbers.
But everybody knows.
But everybody knows.
But everybody knows. And then he and Bodhi, like Patrick Swayze, like have a moment, right?
And that's
in
a
the
genuinely
air.
Fascinating tension.
Right.
That, like, we all know, but we're not saying it.
Right. We all know, but we're not saying it. And then it's, they show him the videotape of Lori Petty, Tyler, right? And
yes.
she's like being
we
kidnapped.
We haven't even mentioned Lori Petty's character.
They use Lori Petty, Tyler as leverage to get him to help rob a bank. This, to me, is when the movie really comes off the rails, right? Is when people start dying.
So when they take Johnny Utah to rob a bank with them, Bodhi breaks his own... Because we have established that the surfers are good bank robbers.
Right.
He breaks his own rule.
Yes.
And he says, let's go in the vault.
Yes.
And that creates the opportunity for chaos to erupt. There's an undercover cop. There's a security guard. That instead of getting in and getting out and taking advantage of shock, they create conditions by which... people are shot and killed.
Right.
And that's all Bodhi's fault.
Yes.
And he's got Lori Petty taken hostage.
Yeah.
She might be killed by his crazy henchmen.
Right.
He's got Johnny Utah breaking his vows as a lawman.
Right.
He's a bad guy.
I'm not going to go that far. Then there's another skydiving scene, right? There's a confrontation at the airstrip.
Well, he gets away. Papadopoulos... breaks him free.
Right, and there's a confrontation at the airstrip where Papadopoulos dies. Spoiler alert.
When you say it this way, I realize how ridiculous it really is. So we've just had an extended skydiving sequence
right.
in a surfing movie. Then there's another bank robbery. Then there's another skydiving sequence where this time it's just Bodhi, Johnny Utah, and Roach, the bank robber who is shot. Roach dies on the way down, which they don't really ever talk about. He's clearly dead on the ground.
He's
clearly
dead.
And they're like, oh, well, that's that other guy died. And so Johnny Utah rescues Lori Petty.
Yeah.
She's released into his loving embrace.
Right.
And Bodhi drives away
yeah.
with his one
Because, again,
henchman.
his body's failed him. They crash landed, like,
yes,
when they
and his legs,
and
give,
his,
out
and
again,
his legs,
right,
give out and his knee gives out. But the final scene.
So we've come this far. There's no
reason
not.
Might as well push through the end.
Because I feel like
end.
The final scene I have some questions about. So what happens in the final scene of the movie?
All right. The final scene of the film is Johnny Utah confronts Bodhi.
A year later.
A year later at the Swell. The
Bell's
Swell
Beach.
That, Bell's
in
Beach.
In Australia.
In Australia. The Swell that happens twice a year.
No. Once every 50 years.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Once every 50 years.
The 50-year wave.
And he lets him go. They have a fight. He handcuffs him. And then he lets him go so that he can surf one final wave when he really knows that Bodhi is going to his death, probably.
So this is what I didn't quite understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have a fight in the surf.
Ah, and then he throws his badge away.
All right, there's two things that don't make sense to me about the ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, he waits a whole year. For some reason, he's still employed as an FBI agent, despite being a bank robber and terrible at his job and insubordinate. For some reason, he still has his job. He leads an army of Australian cops to this cove. They all hang back. He has a terse conversation with Bodhi. They have a fist fight in the surf.
Right.
He handcuffs him.
Right.
And Bodhi's like, you got me, bro. This is the end of the line. You got to let me go to surf one last wave.
Right.
Once again, proving why he is a terrible law enforcement officer, Johnny Utah releases the dangerous murderer from custody for no good reason. Bodhi plunges into this genuinely terrifying-looking wave, and the Australian cops say, that's all right, we'll get him when he comes back up.
And that's the worst Australian.
That's not what matters right now. Johnny Utah says he's not coming back. Why is he not coming back?
Because he's dead.
He's just surfing. It's a big wave, but he's survived worse. So the movie is telling us that this is the end for Bodhi. He's going to die in this giant wave. But I don't quite understand why. Like, we know he's an incredible surfer.
Right.
If anyone could survive the monster wave, it's him.
Well, that's kind of the only ambiguity in the film, is that there's always the hope that Bodhi didn't die. Point Break 2.
Which they didn't make.
Not even Point Break 2, but the audience is invited to empathize with Bodhi, right?
Point Break 2, back to the break.
Can I finish talking?
You can cut that out, sorry.
But the audience is invited to empathize with him because you understand Bodhi's point of view. Yes, he's a bad dude because he was not even just because he was breaking the law, but because those people died, right?
Yeah, I liked him.
Yeah.
I didn't care that he was breaking the law. He's robbing banks. In fact, at one point, he even says to the victims in a bank robbery, you're all insured. He's very clearly not a bad guy. But then, with no real forewarning, he does he makes these terrible decisions that get all his friends killed, and he's completely remorseless about it. Like, I feel like he's revealed to be a sociopath at the end, even if the movie doesn't want us to think that.
I think you could absolutely make the argument that you think he's kind of a sociopath because he just lets his friend's body, lie there in the desert.
Yeah, all his friends get killed, and he's like, woohoo, we're in Mexico. So the final scene of the movie, the last shot of the movie, Keanu Reeves, for some reason, he's still employed as a federal law enforcement officer despite his multiple crimes and inability to do the job effectively. He takes off his badge and throws it in the water.
Yes.
Now, was he remaining on the job as a cop just to do this one last thing that he failed to do, which was arrest Bodhi? Or did something about Bodhi's final moments convince him that he didn't want to be a cop anymore? What happened there?
That's a very good question.
Or is that just a badass thing to do, throw your badge in the water?
No, I think that he was only staying a cop to get closure. And then, I think he had decided through the whole thing, right? Because he started to embrace surfing and bought into all of Bodhi's stuff, right? Bought into his...
The mystical connection to the surf and the ocean and all that stuff.
Right. It's the only reason he lets him go, too, is because he just wants closure. He just wants to get his guy. He doesn't actually want Bodhi to be behind bars for the rest of his life. And he doesn't need to prove anything to the FBI.
I feel like it is ambiguous, and I don't know if this is deliberate or just the wackiness of the movie, whether or not Johnny Utah actually cares about his job as a cop. Like... You could see, you know what? He comes over to the dark side and he embraces the lifestyle of the criminal, and but he doesn't really do that. But there's no moment when there's not a single scene when we see him either trying to explain why he was doing what he did as part of his job as a cop, or throwing away the mantle of law enforcement. It's just completely blank.
I think that's probably in service of Keanu Reeves as an actor. He's definitely one of those actors that the more lines you give him, it doesn't work in your favor.
Yeah, early on in the movie when he's got, as you say, a lot of dialogue, he's a little hard to watch.
I don't know. He does like dopey, he does stoner surfer guy so well that to cast him as the FBI agent, you just are like, oh, this, it's just, it's such a, it's, he's meant to be uncomfortable in that role.
He does feel like a stoner surfer guy when he first reports to work, but he's not a stoner surfer guy at that point. He's a clean-cut all-American
jock.
He's not supposed to be.
Yeah.
But he clearly is one.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of only buy it because you see this young kid who, as Keanu Reeves, like, he's like 25 or something like in the movie. It's kind of like vaguely idealistic, but still too dumb to actually know what's happening.
I feel like the Justice Department should shut down that entire field office.
So one thing that I do want to bring up and that might help us give a little bit more insight into the Johnny Utah character is Point Break and Fast and the Furious. Have you seen, it's not even a meme, this guy put together this flowchart on Twitter, and the flowchart is how to tell if you're watching Point Break or Fast and the Furious.
Because they're basically the same movie.
And they're basically the same movie. One is surfers and the other is dudes with fast cars. They're basically the same movie. They have charismatic, compelling, empathetic antiheroes. They've got a law enforcement agent who goes native. They've got a love interest who is...
Is Paul Walker a cop in the first one?
Yeah, Paul Walker is an FBI agent who's been sent to infiltrate...
So he's Johnny Utah.
He's Johnny Utah.
And Vin Diesel is Bodie.
Yeah, and Vin Diesel is Bodie. And the end, as you know, as Bodie goes away and Johnny Utah lets him go, it's the same thing happens at the end of the original Fast and the Furious. Paul Walker catches Vin Diesel, catches Dom, right? Brian catches
Right.
Brian catches Dominic Toretto. And he goes through a lot of trouble to catch him, too, right? He goes through a ton of trouble, a huge car chase to actually catch him.
I've seen some of those movies, but I couldn't tell you which ones I've seen.
Oh, my God. They're all incredible. But when he finally has him and the cops are coming in and he is like 10 seconds away from actually being arrested, he hands over the keys to his car so that Dominic Toretto can get away.
The car is the wave.
The car is the wave.
Does he throw his badge in the
garage at the end? In the next movie, you see him as an FBI agent, but it's clear that it's not sticking very well. And then in the third movie, he throws his badge away.
In one of the Fast and the Furious movies, Vin Diesel and someone else, a lady, jump out of a helicopter or fall out of a helicopter. I don't remember. And they plummet to this bridge.
He catches her, right?
No, they land on a car.
Yeah.
And they're fine. And she's like, how did you know a car was going to be there to break our fall? He's like, I didn't. And you're supposed to be like, oh, he's so tough. He just took a shot. But if you landed on a car, you would still die. There's no difference between a car and the asphalt for a falling human body.
Yeah, but you're approaching this the wrong way because you're trying to apply logic to these films. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I mean, you could throw us a bone. Oh, also at one point, Johnny Utah, in the second skydiving scene, they jump out of the airplane. The bank robbers jump out of the airplane with their parachutes. Johnny Utah's like, oh man, I don't have a parachute. Nothing I can do.
Oh, it's so good.
But I'm going to jump anyway. And he jumps after them.
Yeah.
And when they land, Bodie says, you are a radical son of a bitch. And it's a great moment.
Yeah.
But that's a deranged thing to do. Like, there's no reason you would ever do that.
Yeah, but like I said, you're trying to apply rational human emotion to an action film. That doesn't make any sense. That's not the point.
All right.
The point is the extremism, right?
Were extreme sports a thing, or did this movie make them a thing?
No, they were starting to become a thing, right? ESPN X Games was like just becoming a thing.
All right, so this was in the culture at the time.
It was just starting to be in the culture. What's super intriguing, I know you keep saying that this movie is all plot. And it is. There's a lot of plot that happens in this movie. But the reason that I think this movie has aged so well and people do like it as a cult classic is partly this relationship between Bodie and Johnny Utah, which is a really... And I think you needed a woman director for this, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And this is where Kathryn Bigelow comes in. It's a romantic relationship. There's like this deep connection. They have a meet cute. He saves Johnny Utah when he's getting beat up by a bunch of folks.
Right, yeah, he saves him from Anthony Kiedis.
Yeah, he saves him from Anthony Kiedis. He like takes him under his wing. He mentors him. And you could argue that the connection that he has with Bodhi is as deep as the connection he has with Tyler Lorre Petty.
Oh, it's way stronger.
It's way stronger.
Also, all of Bodhi's gang, they don't really seem to like Johnny Utah.
Yeah.
But they don't do anything about it because Bodhi loves him.
Right, because Bodhi really likes him. So they let him off the hook. So... that, and I think you did need a female director to be able to give space to those moments to let them happen. Like there's this, I don't think it's a long walk, but Johnny's getting beat up and Bodhi saves him and then they walk to the car. And that scene doesn't need to be as long as it is.
Oh, I know, right. They're walking back to the car.
They're walking back to the car, and they're having a moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, like they're having a moment. They're becoming friends. There's no this like weird dismissal with like a bro hug or whatever.
So I think maybe this is probably a Patrick Swayze acting choice. He plays him like he's ridiculous. He's testosterone marinated, but he doesn't play him that way. Like he has this kind of like this like clarity of speech and. And I like the character. We're supposed to like the character of Bodhi.
Yeah.
And he's got this really like half-assed college sophomore Zen Buddhist kind of philosophy.
Right.
But you could forgive that. What if at the end of the film, though, all they had to do to keep the character's integrity was have him be remorseful, like, oh, he screwed up, right? He pushed it too far. He got his friends killed. That would have been totally in keeping with the character. It would have taken maybe a minute of screen time. And yet they don't do it. So you're left at the end like, oh, this guy was a crazy asshole all along.
I think that might be a nod to the Hollywood system. Because people want very clear...
We needed him to be a villain.
We needed him to be a villain versus much more ambiguous and likable. Because he's a guy who robs banks, so he has to be bad. You know, and there's a lot of things you can blame for it. Maybe it's bad writing. Maybe it's just bad framing of the story. Maybe it's because the studio was like, oh, we need a typical action movie and it needs a little bit, like he needs to be more of a bad guy versus an ambiguous hero, anti-hero.
And I thought that's where it was going. Like when his friends do get shot,
yeah.
Like he's trying to drag the guy to the bank. He's very
he's
upset.
Trying.
Yeah, he can't believe that happened.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's setting you up for like, he's still a good guy beneath his lawless exterior. But yeah, then he's so...
You can say that the movie falls apart there. But back to this relationship that they have together,
yes, the
there's
bromance.
that skydiving scene, which is basically like a love scene, but in the air, where everybody else is skydiving and the other guys fall off one by one, but it's just the two of them left trying to decide who's going to pull their chute first.
That happens twice,
it happens
right?
twice, yeah.
Both
the
scenes,
first time
face to face.
Yeah,
in this.
And they're like incredibly crazy, intimate scenes.
But they're not, I don't feel like, and I'm sure someone would read those as, you know, like, oh, there's a homoerotic subtext. I don't feel that there is, though. Like, I don't think that's in the movie at all.
No, I don't think there's any of that in the film. But I think that it's, like we said earlier, there's so much, like, it's about male bodies and male energy. And to choose a woman to handle all of that, I think is incredibly smart. And Catherine Bigelow did a fantastic job because Lorre Petty's Tyler comes in as a character who takes the place of, I feel she takes the place of the director because she says all the things that a lot of people are thinking, right?
Now, what are your problems with this character, with Tank Girl?
I hate it. I always just hate it when women are always used as the impetus for the men to act.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
He has to go rescue her.
She has very, in the beginning, she starts out having a lot of agency, you know, because she decides, like, she's the one who helps Johnny.
Yeah, she's a very distinct character at the beginning.
Right.
And then she's a plot point at the end.
Exactly. And her character backslides a lot and she gets reduced to a plot point, like, as a love interest.
Yeah, you're right. That's kind of a bummer.
And that's a bummer. And that, to me, I think that Catherine Bigelow is a better director than that. And that seems like people want a damsel in distress. Like, they needed to give him a reason.
And even her, like, a physical presentation of her character. Like, you can totally see how in 1991 in a surfing action movie,
yeah,
that would have been, you know, Pamela Anderson.
Right.
But it's not. It's Lorre Petty, and she's got this, almost like this androgynous vibe.
Yes.
But yeah, you're right. By the third act of the movie, she's just a device.
She is. And they even dress her in a skimpy
white
nightgown, which is, it's just completely unwarranted.
Yeah, she's been wearing skimpy clothes the whole time because they all are.
Right.
But at the end, she's wearing this very, this nightie, basically.
And she's victimized, right? She's turned into a victim, and she wasn't a victim before. And there was no need to do that. Had there been smarter writing, you could have easily gotten
that. Yeah, you could have figured out any number of reasons why he has to go up in the plane and run around. without her being held by a crazed henchman. The entire movie is an extended version of the volleyball scene from Top Gun. It's just like...
The scene where they play football
right.
is basically the Top Gun scene where they play volleyball.
Yeah, they're just men being men and their testosterone.
Right, but again, back to Lori Petty. I keep saying Lori Petty. I don't
she's
need to
say
that.
She's in that scene. Yeah. Like, she's playing football with them, and it's not... A point on
exactly
just, that's what she's doing.
She's playing football with him. Like, it starts off like so promising for this character. Right after that scene mm-hmm. is Lori Petty talking about how all the guys are just full of testosterone. You don't want to get bogged down in that. So that very much to me felt like a directing choice, because for the filmmaker to let us be like, yes, I know exactly what I'm showing you here.
Right.
Like, this isn't a celebration. She was definitely doing it like tongue in cheek.
Yeah, you're right. Like, she's the movie has three characters for the first two acts, maybe four if you count Papadopoulos, and then it loses total interest in her for the final act.
Yeah.
And they kill Papadopoulos.
And they kill Papadopoulos, and it just becomes the two of them.
They didn't need to kill him either. That's unrelated.
They didn't need to kill half these people, but it felt like somebody was like, they're not enough bodies.
They needed to kill the other bank robbers to set the stakes, right? Like,
they
to
needed
show
to kill
that,
one.
Like, at least
they needed
one,
to,
right?
At least one.
Doesn't quite make sense.
I think a lot of it doesn't quite make sense.
I enjoyed the movie, I will say. It's very watchable. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you why I enjoyed it, because it's plainly ridiculous, bordering on nonsensical. But it is fun to watch.
I mean, I love it. I think this movie for me was weirdly, hugely influential because I watched it at exactly the wrong point in my life, or exactly the right point in my life, depending on where you're sitting.
I think you can see the DNA of it much more in modern action movies than a lot of other stuff that was big back then. It's kind of weird that it didn't get a sequel, that they just made it.
Well, then this is when people weren't making sequels.
But Speed had a sequel.
Yeah.
All the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies had sequels.
But maybe they just didn't. Maybe it didn't do that well in the box office.
Maybe it didn't. If anyone's listening from 1991, look and see and tell us, tweet at Hemel, how well did this movie do at the box
actually,
office?
I think that this is kind of like some other Patrick Swayze movies, like Ghost or something like that, which is that I don't think people expected this to do very well. And it's grown over time because... it's such a fun film, like a cult classic, but I don't think at the time that it merited the kind of success that generated sequels.
Now, earlier I referenced the passing of Patrick Swayze, and that triggered a thought you wanted to say something about.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that this is probably one of the best Patrick Swayze roles. Outside of, obviously, Dirty Dancing is the number one,
mm-hmm.
but this is
and
a
Roadhouse.
And Roadhouse. Well, I haven't actually seen Roadhouse.
you're missing. It's
oh, I know.
Treat.
I'm going to. Don't worry. But outside of Dirty Dancing, this is a fantastic role for Patrick Swayze because you need Bodhi to be likable. And Patrick Swayze had never really played a bad guy, right? He comes in with all the baggage of every other role that he's played, which is a good guy who breaks the rules.
Right. Alan Rickman wouldn't have worked as Bodhi.
Exactly. So you are already biased when you come in and you see Patrick Swayze and you're like, oh, this is a good guy who breaks the rules. And that goes a huge way to establishing your empathy for the character because it's Patrick Swayze, even if he's playing Bodhi. And he's got this, I mean, he has this wonderful warmth and charm throughout the entire film.
He has he's very charismatic. He's you want to watch him.
You want to watch him. And as wooden as Keanu Reeves is in any of his Keanu-like line readings that he's, you know, so famous for, Patrick Swayze makes all the corny dialogue that they give Bodhi totally work.
It's believable. Like, you could meet that guy who says that dumb shit and be like, yes, he really believes
this
stuff.
I'm buying what that dude is selling. Like, yes, sign me up.
So when they made this movie, Patrick Swayze was already... I think a movie star, right?
He
had
totally.
Done Ghost and Dirty Dancing.
And he was 39 when he filmed this.
He is in great shape for a 39-year-old man.
I just watched it again and I'm just like super sad that he passed away.
But Keanu had only done the Bill and Ted movies, or the first Bill and Ted. But this was Keanu Reeves' first movie star role.
Really?
I think so, yeah. So is Point Break the beginning of Keanu Reeves?
I don't know.
Or did Bill and Ted make him... I feel like Point Break is his true beginning, because Bill and Ted, and his character in Bill and Ted, it's a comedy movie. It's a sort of, he's this goofy, and he's great at it, but when you look at his career, he's basically kind of an action hero, leading man kind of guy.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, he'd only made that. That didn't make him a movie star.
No, he was in Parenthood, so he had a minor role in Parenthood.
So this is the movie this that gave the movie. Us the modern Keanu.
I think you're absolutely
this
right.
This is the Keanu text.
Yes, the Keanu text.
I think as we, over the course of this podcasting season, continue to interrogate Keanu's importance and centrality to the culture, we will return to Point Break.
I know you're being I know you're being academic and facetious, but I think you're right. In the timeline of Keanu, there's Bill and Ted's, and then there's Point Break.
Yeah, and yeah. Put all the movies he would go on to make, not all of them, most of the movies he would go on to make are more in the Point Break mold than the Bill and Ted mold.
After he does Point Break, there's a Bill and Ted sequel, but in the same year, My Own Private Idaho comes out. Have you ever seen that?
I don't remember.
Whoa.
It's a River Phoenix movie, right?
Yeah. Have you never seen My Own Private Idaho?
I have seen it, but I don't remember Keanu being in it.
He's the other male hustler.
Oh, you're right. It's... Is that on our list of Keanu movies,
no,
too?
No, but it might have to be on it because I totally forgot about it. But he, but you can but you can see this as a point in his career where he got cast as, like, the guy,
is
right?
Is he a comedy actor? Is he a serious dramatic actor? Is he an action star? At this point, he's Schrodinger's Keanu. He has not yet collapsed into a single state.
This, but he definitely cemented his Keanu-ness with this film.
I think so. And yeah, he doesn't quite have his Keanu acting method. Like, in a number of scenes, he blows up, and it's almost comical because he's not really good at playing extreme emotion. But the scenes where he's strong are the scenes where he's just being serene.
Right.
And I think that's what he would go on to lean into as an actor. So in summary, where do we feel Point Break lies in the American canon?
In the American canon?
Or in the Keanu canon?
In the Keanu canon?
Is this his greatest work?
No.
Yeah,
not by far. Not by far. It's not his greatest work. It's not even his most Keanu work.
No, it's not.
It, like you said, it lays the foundation for what Keanu is going to become.
Listeners, we've enjoyed having you with us for this journey into Point Break.
So what we have coming up in this season of Keanu, I'd like to take a look at My Own Private Idaho. We'll be exploring Speed.
Speed, of course.
We'll be exploring The Matrix. The Matrix Trilogy.
I would say that is the height of Keanu.
Okay, Matrix Trilogy. Also coming up, some of the lesser-known rom-coms that Keanu has been in, like The Lake House.
The mid-90s cyberpunk Keanu movies, Chain Reaction and Johnny Mnemonic.
Campbell's
making a face.
Never watched either of those. And I think we'll probably end it with John Wick, which
you
I don't
forgot,
think...
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, yeah, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which we absolutely have to get to.
And Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, which I know I've seen, but I don't remember.
So if you guys are listening, we generally post the podcast on Facebook, so leave us thoughts, comments, criticisms, if you dare. Also, if you have any suggestions for future episodes, give us a shout.
Keanu, Kia, yes.
Oh, God, that's awful. Thanks for listening, guys.